Hello there, and welcome back to Peace in Their Time, episode 169, FDR, part 1. For a change of scenery from the USSR at its most despairing of times, we now turn our attention back to the United States, which also found itself at the most despairing point of its own history. Yes, for this new miniseries, I'm going to be covering the first couple years of the New Deal. Not the entire New Deal, just its first phase, which seems like a small period to focus in on, but consider that America at the start of the Roosevelt administration. It had reached rock bottom economically, and there was a real chance for the nation to fall apart. The fact that it held together was on account of the New Deal, transforming the nature of government power in the U.S. and placing unheard-of peacetime controls on how the nation operated, which, to be fair, was a low bar compared to the state of government in the 20s, when it had been stripped to the bone. And whatever the faults of the New Deal, of which there were many, it kept America in one piece and able to pick up the mighty challenges of the 40s. But before I get too ahead of myself, I left off with the U.S. back in episode 125 with the inevitable, a crushing Republican defeat in the 1932 elections that saw both the White House and Congress be placed squarely in the hands of the Democrats. I say inevitable because President Herbert Hoover's response to the crisis, or rather the non-response, was so bungled that everybody in the GOP accepted the shellacking that was coming to them. If anything, it was a relief to some of those exiting office, as they no longer would have the responsibility of fixing a hopelessly broken country. FDR, though, was raring to go and get down to the business of overhauling the nation. That was easier said than done, but under his administration, the nation would go through an incredible change in how it functioned, and the relationship between citizen and government would never be the same. That all being said, it's appropriate, I think, to pick up the story right after I covered the first five-year plan in the Soviet Union, because the New Deal was the most comparable effort in the United States to that. And it's telling, because they were not like each other at all. Roosevelt, from the outset, was on a mission to save capitalism from itself, not revolutionize the country. He wanted to return America to an earlier state, with safeguards built in to keep it that way. There was no central plan, and the very term New Deal is just an umbrella one used for numerous pieces of disparate reforms that oftentimes butted up and conflicted with each other, which I will get into in a couple weeks. Today, though, I'm starting off with a pair of biography episodes covering the life of Franklin Delano Roosevelt up to his election to the presidency. And if you don't really like these kinds of episodes, relax. These will be the only two of the season. And we're mostly done with them anyway. After FDR is Churchill, and he isn't coming until his rise to power in season 3. FDR, though, is a change of pace from the other figures I've covered in these kinds of episodes. For example, he is the first of the biggest leaders I'm covering that came from an elite background. I mean, Chiang Kai-shek and Mao Zedong both came from above-average circumstances relative to the rest of their countrymen, but that average is taking into account widespread and grinding poverty. Roosevelt came from a privileged family in what was a relatively prosperous country. Which is funny, because while the Roosevelt extended family was certainly prosperous and well-established in the U.S., it had, for centuries, not really been known for a whole lot. During the American Revolution, FDR's great-great-grandfather had been a Federalist and an Alexander Hamilton booster in New York, but avoided the limelight or public office. During the American Civil War, the family stayed out of involvement entirely, which spoke to their privilege that they were able to keep their sons out of the conflict and largely ignore what was such a seismic event in the nation's history. Theirs was a family that had gotten in on the ground floor over a century earlier to even that, and were so entrenched in the world of New York's elites that they didn't feel the need to chase power. They had money, they had connections, and that was enough. This was called out by commentators when both Theodore Roosevelt and FDR had become prominent national figures. Newspapers would comment on how astounding it was that a family that had spent the past six generations twiddling its thumbs and collecting on investments suddenly had two historical giants to its name. Oh, and to explain the relationship between two of the biggest figures in American history, the extended Roosevelt family had two large branches that split off in the early part of the 1800s. One branch was centered around Hyde Park, a town on the Hudson River north of New York City. That one is where FDR hailed from, and the town would remain one of his home bases all his life. The other branch wound up in Oyster Bay in Long Island, and that's where Theodore came from. The division during the 1800s extended to politics in addition to geography. The Hyde Park branch drifted from Federalist to Whig, and then finally to Democrat, while the Oyster Bay clan switched over to Republican in the lead-up to the Civil War, on account of their patriarch at the time being an abolitionist. They still intermingled and kept in touch, along with the extended orbit of blue-blooded families that they kept marrying into. I swear, the upper-class scene in America was almost as bad as the Habsburgs. Okay, maybe not so bad, but if the Habsburgs had a bright, flashing red warning light in their DNA code, the Roosevelts at least had a strong yellow light blinking. I bring this up because James Roosevelt of Hyde Park, definitely not the first of his name, but I'm not counting, got it in his head to court Theodore Roosevelt's sister, Anna. James was 48 and already a widower, and Anna was 22, so she wasn't having that at all. Anna was cool about it, though, and instead of completely shutting him down, she decided to set him up with one of her friends. That would be 26-year-old Sarah Delano. You see where this is going. The Delano family had made their fortune in the early 1800s through getting in early on the China trade, which I can only assume meant a little bit of opium dealing, but they quickly shifted their investments back to the U.S. Sarah, for her part, was 5'10" and was described as looking like a Greek statue. James was infatuated, they were quickly married, and they spent 10 months on a honeymoon circuit of Europe, which was only cut short because it turned out that Sarah was pregnant with little FDR. To explain the future president's three-letter acronym, FDR didn't quite take the Delano part of his name from his mom. Sarah won a light battle of wills with her husband over choosing his first and middle name, and named their son after her own uncle, Franklin Delano, so that's where that came from. The date of birth was January 30th, 1882. Kind of a boring time in history, assuming you didn't live in the global south, of course. Then it would be a very bad time. But in New York, among the elite, things were great. This is kind of weird, because of, you know, on this show I'm used to describing chaotic lives and events set during turbulent times. In addition to the class difference between Roosevelt and the other global leaders of the era I've been covering, his life was markedly placid, which, yes, has given me a good deal of apprehension about devoting too much time to him personally, but he's FDR for crying out loud, so he's still getting more than one episode. But yeah, the environment FDR grew up in, though, was, well, it was handled. He didn't need to worry about anything, really. Oh, the world kept moving on in the background all right there. The use of electricity spread, urban infrastructure changed, modern consumer goods started appearing in stores, the way people lived their lives changed. The Europeans, of course, just kept on getting more and more restless, ominously. But aside from business interests, nothing really intruded onto the Roosevelt clan. They were tucked away from New York City in their manorial enclave. Well, when they weren't on vacation, of course. The family often vacationed to a place called Campobello, which was a small Canadian island so close to the shore to the state of Maine that it was easier to reach it from America than Canada. That's where James went sailing, and where young Franklin picked up the skill as well, one that he would keep up for his entire life. Then there were the weeks to months long trips to Europe, which one in Germany was so extended that FDR spent his time going to school in that country. But upon reaching the age of 14, he would have to take his leave from the vagabond lifestyle that his family's wealth afforded him. Groton is a private boarding school for college-bound teens, and to this day is considered a stepping stone into an elite college, assuming you can get in. Back then, it catered to the Northeast elite of the country, so getting in was impossible without coming from wealth and connections. I add connections to that because when FDR went, the student body amounted to only 120 students total, so you had to have some real blot to get in, to borrow a Stalinist-era phrase. Life at the school was designed to deny the comforts of cushy homes for the students, and challenge their physical fitness to ensure they didn't get slothful. The idea was, of course, to toughen the little aristocrats up a bit, although I'm curious of how effective that really was when administered over just a four-year period with, you know, breaks included. Because, you know, the students would have perfect knowledge that they would be fine. Yeah, school would be tough, but they're going to go home eventually. To me, it seems like something designed for them to recall fondly on how they had, quote-unquote, earned their stripes more than anything else. What I'm getting at is that it was a performatively stern environment. Really just there to weed out the terminally hopeless among the upper class. But oh yeah, FDR. He was fine, I guess. He didn't stick anybody with a penknife, and he didn't set up a revolutionary reading group. We're a ways into the episode, and I've really scarcely talked about him personally because he wasn't that notable of a youth. He got good grades, he functioned perfectly well away from home. I suppose an important thing to point out was that he very quickly grasped the social game in play among the elites. He ingratiated himself with not only his fellow students, but the adult staff as well. Otherwise, it's kind of his environment guiding his life. He was locked into the ride that the upper class strived to perpetuate through the generations of their families. All he had to do was not screw up, and he'd be fine. And he didn't screw up. The story repeated itself when he went to Harvard. Good student, not great, but good. He worked on the school newspaper, was active on the social scene, and was the chairman of his class. He wasn't an intellectual, but he instinctively knew how to play the game. His mother remained a presence in his life throughout. When he was still a teen, his father, James, had suffered a heart attack and become increasingly frail, making Franklin closer to his mom as they took care of James. Then in his first year of Groton, his father suffered another round of heart attacks and died. Their mourning period included a vacation to Europe, where the Roosevelts actually hung out with Kaiser Wilhelm II on board his yacht off the coast of Norway. When Franklin went to Harvard, Sarah herself moved to Boston, not wanting to be alone at Hyde Park. She wasn't totally fixated on her son and quickly acclimated to Boston's social circles, and Franklin was glad to have her close by enough that he could drop in when he wanted to. Like so many other guys I've covered in their bio episodes, he was kind of a mama's boy. But just after Harvard, Eleanor entered the picture. Oh, Eleanor, probably the greatest first lady of all time. It's a shame that by the time she came to the White House that their marriage was effectively a political arrangement only, which we'll talk about next week. Still, out of all the spouses I brought up, Eleanor is the one who far and away mattered the most. So she's going to be getting some time here too. Good thing, because I readily admit these bio episodes basically constitute a boys' club. But anyway, Eleanor Roosevelt didn't actually get the last name from marriage. She hailed from the Oyster Bay branch of the family and was the niece of Theodore Roosevelt. Her upbringing was a great deal more unfortunate than Franklin's was. Her father, Elliot Roosevelt, was a useless drunk and every bit the cautionary tale of unchecked wealth and privilege. Still, it took time for his self-destructive tendencies to catch up with him. He married Anna Rebecca Hall, yet another well-connected and well-bred heiress, and a beauty to boot. For a brief moment, it seemed like the match would calm him down. Then Elliot went right back to drinking and hitting up the nightlife. By the time the couple's third child was born, Elliot and Anna's marriage was effectively over. Plus, Elliot had acquired a morphine addiction that was speeding up his self-destruction. Theodore had to intervene against his little brother and brought a lawsuit to declare him insane so his property and fortune could be placed in a trust. This created a fun little scandal and resulted in the brothers having a week-long argument in Paris in 1892. Elliot agreed to turn over almost everything in exchange for not being forcibly committed. That didn't slow him down, though, and he wound up knocking up a servant girl named Katie Mann. The Roosevelts paid some hush money to keep Katie quiet about her newborn son, although by all accounts her lawyers made off with the $10,000 that was paid out. Sad note, Eleanor's half-brother later reached out in 1932 via a letter, to which she replied that she would be interested in meeting him one day. She never actually got around to following up on that, the reasons for which are probably not hard to imagine. Anna took charge of the family, while Elliot bounced around stints of rehab. Anna was not long for the world, though, and in December 1892 died, aged only 29, of diphtheria, an infection of the throat. 6 months later, Eleanor's little brother, Elliot Jr., died of the same disease, aged only 3. This understandably left quite a mark on the young Eleanor, who was only 10 at the time. Elliot Sr. would himself be dead by August 1894, which was the death that everybody kind of saw coming. Eleanor would later speak ruefully of her mother and glowingly of her father, likely because for all his faults, Elliot was a charming fellow. She thereafter came into the care of her Aunt Anna, the same Anna that James Roosevelt had originally intended to marry before she deflected him to Sarah Delano. Her cousin Alice, Theodore's party girl daughter, would note that Eleanor had low self-esteem in terms of her body image, which Alice would dispute the validity of, but then again, Eleanor was mostly just depressed in general. Cannot say that I blame her at all. It did lead her to keep to herself and a smaller-than-would-otherwise-be-expected social circle. By the time she was 18, she really hadn't been out and about in the world, and by that I mean spent much time around men, which might be what made her and Franklin click at first. She had a certain seriousness and reserve that appealed to him. Reportedly, FDR was intimidated by the women who counted themselves as social gadflies among the blue-blooded circles. They were too quick, too aggressive, too calculating for his tastes. Eleanor was intelligent and active in the world around her, but without throwing it in one's face. There was also the little fact that Eleanor was the beloved niece of Theodore Roosevelt, Cousin Teddy, who was also President of the United States. For an ambitious young man, it was a perfect connection to make. According to those around him, he was calling his shot to be president from the very start. For Eleanor, Franklin was a handsome young man who defied the expectations of her own low self-esteem and took a genuine interest in her. They were just 2 years apart in age and got on splendidly, which was sad considering the gulf between them later in life. They made an excellent team when they were together. Shortly after Franklin entered Columbia Law School in the fall of 1904, they were engaged. They were married in March of 1905, with Eleanor being walked down the aisle by Uncle Theodore himself, which was a mixed blessing as while it was cool to have the president give away the bride, he kinda stole the show for the special day as well. Theodore's own daughter Alice would remark later, "Father always wanted to be the bride at every wedding and the corpse at every funeral." Being engaged and then freshly married played hell on FDR's attendance at Columbia, where he recorded 73 absences in his first year and saw his grade slip to where he was placed in the middle of his class. Not that it mattered, he was gallivanting around Europe with Eleanor, and they were both too well connected to fail. FDR managed to pass the bar in the middle of his third year, and immediately left school to get a job at a law firm, never earning a degree in law. Probably good for him to get going with life, as his and Eleanor's family was going to balloon very quickly. They wound up having 6 kids in their first 10 years of marriage, although tragically one would die as a baby. So he needed to get a job, trust fund or no. Neither one of the young parents was terribly well-equipped to run the household. FDR deferred to Eleanor, while Eleanor had been raised to depend on servants for such duties as taking care of very young children and keeping a house in order. The dynamic changed a little as the kids grew up, with FDR playing at being the cool dad who played games with the kids, while Eleanor played bad cop and kept them from acting out too much. In his work at the law firm, FDR showed little interest. He rose through the ranks decently enough, and as always, he made friends and connections above all else. His bosses recognized this, and overlooked his lack of commitment at work with the knowledge that his background and social talent could pay off in different ways. That Franklin himself was throwing around the idea of getting into public service confirmed for them that he could prove useful in a slightly different capacity. Word must have filtered out to the New York Democrats that there was a scion of an old house looking to take a dip into politics. In the summer of 1910, he was invited by John Mack, the district attorney of Dutchess County and a bigwig of the party in New York State. FDR was advised that the state assemblyman of the county was considering retirement, and Mack suggested he started getting to know local figures. FDR was delighted with the idea, and after securing money from his mom, as she still managed his trust, he started setting up a campaign. Then, in mid-September, the assemblyman, who was retiring, decided to unretire and keep going. FDR was furious with being jilted and threatened Mack with running as an independent. I can only imagine what Mack, a political veteran and one of those salt-of-the-earth types used to appealing to immigrants and farmers, must have felt by being threatened by a 28-year-old without an achievement to his name. Still, Mack was a politician, and instead of making an enemy, he deflected FDR by suggesting he run for a state Senate seat covering a stretch of the East Hudson River instead. The seat was more prestigious than that of an assemblyman, but the trick was that the chances of actually winning it were a lot lower. The Republican incumbent had won his last election in a landslide. But this was 1910, when the national progressive tide was getting ready to hit its apex, and when the Taft administration's bumbling had tarnished the Republican brand. Also, Cousin Theodore helped out too. In a prelude to the founding of the Bull Moose Party that would split the Republicans in 1912, he publicly dressed down the Republican Party leadership of the state of New York when they came out against Governor Charles Evans Hughes' electoral reform measures. Hughes was a Republican who wanted to change the laws so that political parties had to decide on their candidates through direct primaries rather than the party bosses setting the ticket. This united both the GOP state leadership and the Democrat Tammany Hall clique against him and enraged Theodore. Suddenly, the Republican Party was in disarray. Charles Evans Hughes is an interesting, if also largely forgotten, figure in American history. I've already introduced him as the Secretary of State that guided along the Washington Naval Treaties in the 20s, but he was a lot of other things, too. The electoral reform fiasco was such that Hughes wanted out of the governorship, and President Taft put him on the Supreme Court in October 1910. He resigned in 1916 so that he could run for president against Woodrow Wilson, which he lost. He got back into politics for the Secretary of State gig, eventually resigning in 1925. A few years later, he had a stint as a judge on the Court of International Justice with the League of Nations, despite the U.S. not being a member. In 1930, Hoover offered him the spot of Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, which Hughes accepted. That last bit is what's important for our purposes, as it would be the Hughes Court that would be the main foe to many of FDR's New Deal reforms. So, just a little bit of table setting for you there. Even though we won't be getting to that part of the New Deal's history in this miniseries, that'll be for later in the season. FDR ran a very DIY campaign, renting a little car and driver to whisk him up and down the 90-mile-long, 30-mile-wide district. This was before campaigning by car was common, so it was a strange sight for the farmers living in the area. Roosevelt would talk up everybody under the sun during his travels, whether it was curious crowds in the small towns or individual farmers passing by on the road. He railed against corruption in the establishment of both parties, and since the Republicans had effectively forced Hughes from the governorship, Roosevelt could speak warmly of him since he was gone. The starting odds were such that Republicans didn't pay him much mind, but at the end realized that they might have underestimated the neophyte. They went on the attack, but it was too little, too late. Roosevelt edged out his opponent, taking just slightly over half the vote. It wasn't exactly a ringing endorsement of Roosevelt. He had outspent his competition 5-1, had campaigned like his life depended on it, and it was a banner election year for Democrats across the country. Still, a win was a win. Despite being an enthusiastic campaigner and far from being shy of the press, it turned out the youthful FDR wasn't automatically a capable politician. Upon arriving in the state Senate, he immediately got into a tangle against the dominant Tammany Hall clique, a struggle that he would keep up off and on all through his career. Just a little sidebar, the Tammany Hall political machine had a much longer life than the one presented in most high school textbooks. It reached the height of its notoriety under the leadership of the infamous Boss Tweed during the back half of the 1800s, and his corruption was such that he became the poster boy of corruption in New York City, a tension that led to his downfall and arrest. Tammany Hall, though, carried on as usual, buying up votes, setting up politicians from its own ranks, and maintaining a seemingly unbreakable patronage network. The machine was only wound down during the 1960s, falling on account of FDR decisively turning against them, Republicans enjoying long stretches of being in control of New York City appointments, and alternative centers of influence rising in the city. Al Smith, who would eventually become FDR's mentor and then a bitter detractor, was allied with Tammany Hall and wrote him off as a dilettante. Sure, Roosevelt picked fights with the establishment, but not really to any greater purpose. He didn't really have a legislative vision, which was not surprising given his upbringing. He had experienced remarkably few problems in life that needed fixing. Francis Perkins, eventually FDR's Secretary of Labor, did not mince words even upon decades of remove regarding her early experience with Roosevelt. She worked as a lobbyist in Albany on behalf of labor causes, and was notable for being on a commission investigating a disastrous fire in a clothing factory that had killed almost 150 people, 100 in the fire, the rest from jumping out of the upper floor windows on account of there not being any fire escapes. Most of the victims were young women, and naturally for 1911 America, the business itself was held to the barest hint of responsibility. Reforming working conditions became a priority of the legislature for years afterwards, but Roosevelt sat on the back bench and ignored the work being done around him. When Perkins personally approached him to support a law to reduce working hours, he brushed her off saying that he couldn't on account of more pressing matters. What those pressing matters were, he didn't say. Ultimately, it was the Tammany crowd that got progressive reforms through the legislature. Their arrangement with the working class was that they'd deliver on their behalf, so as corrupt as they were, they had an incentive to at least get something done. The work hour reform law Perkins had pressed on him was barely passed, with Roosevelt absent entirely from the Senate at the time. Where he proved more capable was in nature conservation. Which, certainly important, but maybe doesn't explain away his indifference from what directly impacted people's lives at the time. In this, though, he followed in Cousin Theodore's footsteps and pushed efforts to cordon off vast tracts of land from exploitation. This provoked his first conflicts with the business class, which overlapped considerably with his own social circle. He resisted pressure against him, though, and pushed initiatives to safeguard the natural beauty of the New York interior. Which not only was a perfectly inoffensive passion, as long as you weren't, in the logging or mining industry, but one that gave him credibility to call himself an active progressive, and therefore enter into the orbit of Woodrow Wilson. The two met and got on well enough while Wilson's own star was rising, but for both of them, the 1912 Democratic Presidential Convention would be the breakthrough. For Wilson, that was obviously because he got the nomination and he would go on to become president. For FDR, though, it was more how the convention played out that helped him. Wilson was not the favorite for most of the proceedings. Keep in mind, this was back in the days when party delegates all got together into a big room and conspired against each other. A guy named Champ Clark was actually the frontrunner, but he couldn't quite get the necessary support to cease the endless rounds of votes. The Tammany faction were diehard supporters of Clark, while Roosevelt personally was off on the sidelines, not really doing a whole lot. Then William Jennings Bryan, one of the greatest presidential election losers of all time, and a bunch of other things I won't get into, entered the fray and got behind Wilson. Slowly, the rest of the party followed suit, and Wilson came from behind to get the nomination. Now, FDR hadn't really done much to help, but the Tammany faction's steadfast support of Clark meant they weren't regarded as friends of Wilson's. But FDR was, and so he became Wilson's man on the scene in New York. It was looking like the 1912 campaign would be a banner year for Roosevelt, but just as he was set to begin his own campaign for re-election, he was struck with typhus, which Eleanor blamed on contaminated drinking water while on a vacation trip up in Campobello. Roosevelt was bedridden for the campaign, but luckily had secured the loyalty of a part-time journalist and possible crazy person, Lewis Howe. Howe was a political junkie of the First Order and worked as a reporter for Albany Politics. Thing was, back in those days, Albany Politics only ran for part of the year, and he worked as a starving writer for the rest. He had come to admire FDR over his fights with Tammany, and Roosevelt was aware of that admiration. Howe was offered the job of campaign surrogate, a task he leapt on immediately. This might have been the first of many instances where FDR inspired such devotion in a follower that his ass was comprehensively saved. Howe took over the automobile tour himself and campaigned day and night, pushing people to re-elect Roosevelt. He was just as good a promoter as Roosevelt himself, if not better, and coupled with another banner Democratic year nationally, FDR won re-election by a bigger margin than previously. Still wrecked from typhus, Roosevelt returned to Albany. Howe, for his part, would be by FDR's side from that point until his own death in the mid-30s. Since he knew Roosevelt from such an early stage, he was one of the few people comfortable with calling the president out on his own BS and, do a little reality check. It took him and Eleanor a little while to warm to each other, but when she realized he really just wanted to make her husband a more effective politician, she treated him as an effective member of the family. Roosevelt, for his part, wasn't long for Albany politics, though, and gauging by how he acted after re-election, he might have known that. He had successfully ingratiated himself with Wilson, and was sure to be present with Eleanor during the inauguration ceremonies, reminding everyone how he had backed the right horse. And Wilson remembered that too, rewarding FDR with his desired post as Assistant Secretary to the Navy Department, the same posting Theodore had occupied on his own way up. In just a couple of years, Roosevelt had gone from a neophyte state senator to number two in the Navy Department. And the change of scenery to Washington, D.C. would naturally open many new doors for the increasingly ambitious young man. Which is where I will start off next week, as I pick up the narrative to cover FDR's life in the national spotlight up to his election in 1932. Join me then, and as always, thank you very much for listening. We'll be right back.